Hi, I'm Kim Chaganeta, and this is The Comb, a BBC World Service original podcast. Each week, I comb the continent for stories that matter. Online, we're hashtag The Comb. In this episode, not guilty. The nightmare scenario that feels like it could never happen to you. What's it like to be falsely accused? To find yourself labelled as something you're not, condemned to take a punishment you know you don't deserve, and to have to find a way forward for your life, forever changed. This is Ishmael's story.
This is The Comb.
You need The Comb.
The Comb, no.
Need The Comb.
The Comb.
My name is Ishmael Gome. I come from Chizumbu village in Dedza district in Malawi.
I'm speaking to Ishmael over the phone from his home in Dedza district in central Malawi. It's an area dominated by maize farmland, currently lusciously green as the rainy season has just begun. And Ishmael is sat in the entrance of his home, a small mud hut with a grass-thatched roof. Ishmael's not used to giving interviews, so as well as my colleague Peter, he's also got his wife and daughter and the village chief close by for moral support.
Chizumbu village is where I was born, and I lived here all my life. The people here spend their time working as farmers, praying. People like to join groups as a way to better their lives.
What were the values that you lived by? What was important to you?
I was always taught that I should live well with my relatives and also with visitors from outside so that they could also appreciate Malawian culture.
It's a place where everyone knows everyone, where life follows a pattern laid out by generations before. Hard work, family, faith in God. Ishmael had always assumed he'd spend his whole life here. And in 1982, he found a partner to build his own family with.
Of course. When you grow up, a time comes when you know that you need to get married.
And how did you meet?
Our villages were close to each other, so I used to visit the neighboring village where she was, and that's how we met.
And was it love at first sight?
I would say it took about 2 weeks. We were chatting, she would come to visit our village, and I would also go to her village to buy fish from her brothers. That's how our love affair started. And later on, we got married.
And what was your life like together?
After we got married, my life was very happy. I was a simple farmer. After I had finished work farming, my wife would make me food and give me water for a bath. Then after that, I would go out for my other business. I used to sell fish at the drinking joints.
And what was it that made you most happy, most joyful during that period?
What made me most happy during that time was just working together with my wife, because we both believed in God. We knew that God wants people to love each other. So I was happy because we used to praise God every day.
Ishmael had everything in place that he needed for a good life, for himself, his wife, and their children. But he had other aspirations as well.
I was hoping to get some tools for carpentry because I'd learned carpentry using my homemade equipment. I was hoping that with my farming and fish business combined, I could afford proper tools from a shop. That was my dream.
And what about the police or justice system? Did you have any encounters with them?
Growing up, I saw the police, but I never knew what their job was. You'd see them around, but I didn't really understand what they did. I just knew they were there to protect Malawian citizens. That's how I viewed them.
So in terms of your feelings towards them, how would you describe how you felt?
At the time, I respected the police because I thought they had an important job protecting the lives of Malawians.
This comfortable life, which Ishmael had built for himself and his family, felt like it was set forever. But in 2004, everything changed. Ishmael remembers his last day of normality and the kind of detail that suggests someone who's retold it over and over. As usual, his day had started with working in the garden.
I came from farming my garden, got home, took a bath, then my wife served me my meal. Then I went to the drinking joint to sell my fish. I was sat on the veranda to sell. Someone was selling the local gin, kachasu, so I bought some of that, and then I just stayed there drinking. Then Chief Chizimbu came with his younger brother. They sat as well. Then later, Folias and our nephew, Lucas, joined us.
It was a family group. Ishmael's uncles, including the chief, his cousin Folias, and his nephew Lucas, all relaxing together.
We drank until it was time to go. The sun was setting. It was around 7:30. Everyone was leaving to go back to their homes. So I packed up the fish I was selling to go home as well. As I whirled home, Folia's father was behind me. We were going in the same direction because Folia's father had to go past my house on the way to his. So I got home first, and then he carried on to his house. Everyone went home and slept. In the morning, it was time for everyone to go to our gardens again. But before I could leave the house, an aide to Chief Chizumbu visited me. He said, "Hello, how did it go yesterday when you went out drinking with Folias?" I told him that everything was okay. Everyone just went home to their houses. And then he said to me, "What I wanted to tell you is that your brother who you were with has been found dead."
Folias, Ishmael's cousin, the child of his mother's younger sister, the close relative who he had been sat on the veranda drinking with just a few hours earlier, was dead. And that wasn't all.
He said, "Investigations show that you were the last one seen with him." Folias and me, we grew up together. We loved each other ever since we were young. We never quarreled. We used to work together to help the chief resolving village disputes. Actually, the chief was teaching us both, knowing that he would one day pass the leadership mantle to us.
For Ishmael, it was crazy to think that anyone would consider that he might have wanted to harm the man who he considered a brother, who he'd never fought with. But an investigation had now begun, with Ishmael as one of the suspects.
The matter was taken to Chief Chipeni, who was in charge of security in the village. He called a meeting of all young men in the village to investigate what had happened. But when he called us, there was one person missing. It was my sister's son, Pitilizan. People were sent to look for him, and they found him sleeping even though the sun was already up. So then he was brought to the meeting, and the police were informed. The police went to the scene where my brother Folias was killed. They found some footsteps at the scene. So they followed them and they led right to the doorsteps of my nephew, Peter Lizan. So then the police said that all the young men in the village must come to the police station and explain what they knew about what happened. So we were all put in a vehicle and taken to Lintipe police station where we were questioned.
Ishmael says he was questioned about his movements the day before. He explained how he had taken fish to sell at the drinking joint, how he had drunk with Folias and the others until the joint closed, then packed up his fish and walked home with Folias' father. He knew Folias' father had seen him reaching home. But if Ishmael had thought that this was going to be a simple matter of answering the questions and then coming back home, he was mistaken. He and the other men were kept at the police station for 2 weeks.
At the police station, it was really hard. Every day people were being beaten. The thing that gave me hope was that I wasn't being beaten myself. They were just asking me questions.
Despite being held for so long, Ishmael was reassured. He knew that he'd been witnessed arriving home that night, and his nephew, Pitili Zani, seemed like the clear suspect. There had literally been footprints leading from the murder scene to his house. But at the start of the second week, Ishmael was allowed a break outside with the other men, and his other nephew, Lucas, sought him out with a devastating bit of information.
My nephew Lucas told me what was being planned behind the scenes. He said to me, "Mr. Gome, they are plotting to implicate you. They say if the young man goes to prison alone, he will be killed, because when one person kills another person, they are killed. So he must insist he was not alone. He must implicate me as well, even though it wasn't like that."
So according to Lucas, Pitili Zani knew he would be found guilty for the murder. But he thought that saying someone else had been involved alongside him would mean he'd get a more lenient sentence. He had chosen Ishmael as that second person.
I was devastated. I stopped eating because I was hurting so much.
Sure enough, the next day, of the 8 men who had been brought to the police station together, all were released except for Pitili Zani and Ishmael. For Ishmael, this could only mean one thing. He had the horrifying realization that after waiting for the police investigation to play out, assuming it would conclude that he wasn't involved, the opposite had happened. Whatever investigation had occurred, the conclusion they reached was that he and Pitili Zani were both the murderers. On the 7th of September 2005, the case went to court. Ishmael was utterly unprepared. He says he'd had no opportunity to meet with his lawyer before the trial, and the family members who'd been present that night and could have spoken up in Ishmael's defense weren't presented to testify. Ishmael could only watch on as his nephew Pitili Zani made his own confession and told the court the lie that Ishmael had been his accomplice. And that wasn't all. The police had something to present in court which seemed to confirm Ishmael's involvement: a signed confession. Police said that you confessed to killing your cousin. Did you think you made a confession? I mean, how did that come about?
What I was told was I was signing just to confirm what my name was and whether I was able to write. I didn't know it was going to be used against me in the future.
Looking back now, Ishmael says he understands how this apparent signed confession had come about. He says it happened after a week and a half in custody, during which he had been beaten and deprived of food. So when he was presented with a piece of paper and told to sign it, he did. But Ishmael was illiterate. He says he had no idea what the paper said.
I didn't have any reason to hide my name. So I wrote down my name letter by letter. It wasn't a signature because I don't have a signature. I write my name letter by letter. I didn't know that this was going to be used for something sinister, let alone.
Of the 12 jurors at trial, 10 voted to find Ishmael guilty.
High Court, Deza.
It was in Deza High Court that the judge pronounced the death sentence.
A death sentence. At the time, Malawian courts gave the death sentence automatically in cases of murder. In reality, no executions had actually been carried out since 1992. But this temporary ban, called a moratorium, wasn't official. And human rights lawyers say it was never clearly explained to the death row inmates. So Ishmael was put on death row. He slept just meters away from the gallows and had to live with the knowledge that executions might resume at any time. As a best-case scenario, he was expected to spend the rest of his life in prison without parole. Pitili Zani, meanwhile, had followed his plan. He pleaded guilty to manslaughter, meaning he got a less severe punishment. He was given a regular prison sentence instead, while Ishmael went to death row alone. Ishmael felt totally defeated.
When I heard the sentence, it hurt. I heard I was going to be hanged. I was thinking too much. For 3 days, I didn't eat.
On the fourth day, a prison warden intervened.
A prison warden said to me that you need to eat so that your body stays strong and ready. If you stop eating, your body will be unwell. If it is God's wish to save you, he will save you. You need to be ready when the time comes.
This was the reminder Ishmael needed, that in order to get the justice he so badly wanted, he needed to stay alive to fight for it.
So I started eating again.
So Ishmael settled into his new reality. Ishmael doesn't speak much about his time incarcerated, but the prison had been condemned as unfit for human habitation by the prison's inspectorate nearly 10 years before Ishmael arrived and was never updated or modified in the meantime. Conditions on death row were reported to be especially bad, with each cell just 8 by 6 feet, shared by 4 prisoners. The cells were empty except for a bucket and 2 blankets per prisoner. Condemned prisoners like Ishmael were separated from the rest of the inmates, excluded from all activities, including church services. Ishmael's health declined, and he frequently suffered from malaria. But as the days passed by and he looked ahead to the rest of his life locked up, by far the hardest thing for Ishmael was letting go of his life on the outside. He knew that his wife and his 4 children would all be struggling, having lost their primary breadwinner.
Prison life is very difficult. On the outside, you can work and support your children. But in prison, you no longer have that chance. It bothered me. Who is taking care of my children now? What kind of struggles are they going through? I used to be troubled thinking about that.
Ishmael was being held in Zomba, more than 3 hours away from Deza district, and his family couldn't often afford the journey to the prison. There was no access to phone calls, and since he'd never learned to read or write, he couldn't keep contact through letters. As the years passed by, Ishmael's family moved on.
All your plans are ruined. You're not doing anything. I just worried every day. It made my blood pressure go up. I would ask myself, is this what God wanted me to do? What future do I have now?
Days became weeks, became months, became years. Ishmael had always had faith, but in prison, his relationship with God became one of the most significant forces keeping him going. An American woman volunteering in the prison encouraged him to keep faith and even to find forgiveness for his nephew, who was serving his sentence in the same prison.
She used to say, you shouldn't keep a grudge against the person who implicated you. You should chat with him. God will save you. So I was doing exactly that. I chatted with him. We were in different parts of the prison, but I would call for him and we would chat. I still thought of him as a relative. I knew he didn't really want to implicate me, but he thought that he had no choice. So, I forgave him.
Could you find any joy in prison life?
When I was in the prison, I never found anything good. Nothing in prison is joyful.
Obviously, prison is going to be a challenge for anyone. But in your case, on top of all the other hardships, you also had to live with the injustice that you were actually innocent. Did that not make life harder for you?
When I was in prison, although I was angry, I tried hard to stay calm so that I could still have a future. The aim was to show good behavior, not to have fights or quarrels with anyone. I was hoping that the bosses in the prison would escort me nicely to court one day.
And were you still holding on to the hope that your name would be cleared?
I knew the day would eventually come where I would be cleared. I had dreams that showed me that there were good things in my future, so I always had hope.
In 2015, more than a decade after he first walked through the doors of the prison, things suddenly changed again. Human rights lawyers came and they were reviewing cases like Ishmael's, where they felt there might be a miscarriage of justice. When they spoke to Ishmael's nephew, Patilizani finally admitted that he had falsely accused Ishmael, his uncle, of being jointly responsible for the murder. Ishmael heard the news from Patilizani himself.
He finished his meeting with the white man and he came straight to explain it to me. He said he told the white man about how he had been misled at the time to implicate me. He said he wanted to wish me the best for when I went to court. so that God would help and I would be free.
What was your reaction to hearing your nephew confess to you after all this time?
When I heard, I was very happy. I knew God wants us to be forgiving when someone does something wrong. I was so happy. I knew his confession would help me when I went back to court.
It had been 10 years since he'd been found guilty and nearly 12 and a half years of incarceration, including the time before his trial. 12 and a half years in which Ismail had been locked up, been painfully separated from his family, endured the dangers, physical hardships and psychological agonies of life on death row, and watched his old dreams of expanding his businesses and building a better future wither and die. But now, after all that, Bitili Zani was finally speaking the truth. So he didn't need to confess. He could have just kept quiet. Do you know why it was he chose to tell the truth at that particular time?
I think he reflected on his life and on his relationship with me as his uncle, and he decided to confess, not just to the world, but also to God. He wanted God's forgiveness.
So the case was finally being re-examined, and Ismail had reason to hope again. It's difficult to imagine the intensity of emotions, hope but not yet certainty, after such a long time. As he waited for his resentencing hearing, Ismail experienced vivid dreams.
I was in a tall building in the prison, with a window far away right at the top. At around midnight, I had a dream. I saw someone at the window. I removed the blanket from my head to see. The person was black. Only his hand came through the window, and he was waving bye-bye to me. I was filled with fear because I had never had a dream like that before. I hid my face in the blanket. In the morning, I heard that I'd be going to court the next day. I was so happy. I bade farewell to my friends, and they were wishing me well with my case. The prison authorities even organized a football match for the prisoners to celebrate that I was going to court, and for everyone to wish me good luck for getting released. After the football match, I went back to sleep, and I had another dream. I was going somewhere, but there was a person in a black robe walking in front of me in the clouds. Just when I was about to arrive wherever I was going, the person disappeared, and then I woke up.
When the day finally came, some things must have been horribly familiar. The imposing courtroom, lawyers discussing his fate while Ismail himself sat silently. But this time it was different. This time he knew the lawyers. He had spoken to them before, and he knew they were on his side. And he knew that his nephew wasn't lying anymore. There was a statement from Bitili Zani himself submitted to the court at Ismail's sentencing rehearing, including the crucial admission.
Ismail Gome was not present on the evening of 11th January 2004 when I struck and killed Foliasi Chibasi. Ismail Gome is innocent.
The court was told that Bitili Zani had become more religious since his incarceration, and he felt terrible about falsely implicating his uncle, because God knows I've sinned. And so this time, when the proceedings finished, Ismail's life had been forever changed again.
All I heard was the judge said, "Ismail Gome, we see no reason for arresting him. He's free. He can leave using any exit of his choice." And the lawyers all put their books down, and that was the end.
That was the end. The lawyers who had won him his freedom drove Ismail back to the prison for the last time to collect his belongings. He picked up some clothes and some leaflets, his only physical souvenirs from the last decade of his life, and he walked out of the prison for the last time. Ismail was driven as far as a trading center near his village, and the next day was given money for a bicycle taxi to take him home.
They said I shouldn't walk because my legs had forgotten how to walk. They said I should take a bicycle taxi instead. But I said, I want to walk. I want to stretch my legs. So I used the taxi money to buy sugarcane instead. And I walked.
Even that walk home was full of the signs of how the world had kept going while Ishmael was locked away. There was new infrastructure, and some of the paths he was used to were now closed. Things were so different, Ishmael couldn't be sure he was going the right way.
I asked around for directions. Please, how do I get to Chizumbu? They told me. It's just after those houses. Finally, I got here.
What was it like to finally be free?
When I came out of prison, it felt very good. When I walked, I was free and happy like before. Even in the surrounding villages, people were happy to see me. They would say, hello, hello. I was like a new baby or someone arisen from the dead.
So it had finally happened. Vindication, freedom. But what was freedom now? After 10 years separated from his home and his loved ones, Ishmael couldn't return to the same life he'd left behind. His wife, his first love, who he'd built his future with, had moved on. Ishmael faced big questions now about the shape of his new life after prison. But first, he just wanted to enjoy some of the simple luxuries that he'd been denied.
One of the things I missed most that I couldn't get in prison was tea. Actually, it was like I had to learn to drink tea again. I couldn't finish a cup of tea at first, but now I can do it again, and I can finish a cup of tea.
Can I ask why you couldn't finish it? What was it about the cup of tea?
I don't know, but maybe my stomach became smaller. I'm glad now I'm able to enjoy tea again.
Life is very different for Ishmael now. He's married again and is happy to be back among his neighbors and extended family. His dream of turning his carpentry into a proper business is long gone. But having the freedom to farm again is a gift enough for now. Ishmael, I know that your faith in God meant that forgiveness has always been your first priority. But we can't underestimate the wrong that you suffered. We each only get one life, and 10 years of your life was stolen from you. Has forgiveness been a challenge?
No, I think I've always been a forgiving person, even since I was young. Not returning evil with evil is something that I learned from a young age. I grew up with it because of believing in the word of God. So I teach children and my relatives that they should also learn to forgive. When something wrong happens, I say they mustn't rush to be angry. They must forgive the person who wronged them.
So when you look back at what happened to you, you don't have any feelings of anger or resentment about how your life was changed and the unfairness of how it was changed by something that was not your fault?
It's all behind me now. I don't want to dwell on the past. The case has been concluded, and I'm happy in my heart that it is all closed. I am free to chat with anyone, relatives or strangers. I don't worry about the past now. I just want to move forward.
Thank you for listening to this episode. Next week on The Comb.
I couldn't really say to her, this is the type of teaching that we are receiving there, because I know she would have said, no, this is a cult. She would have definitely said, get out. But then I wouldn't have. So that caused a huge drift with our relationship, with just all the secretiveness that was happening.
This episode was produced by Mary Goodhart and me, Kim Chakaneta. The sound design was by Marco Orionto. Stuart Holling-Drake is our studio manager, and Piers Lynch is our editor. Gabriel Kamlomo read the voice of Ishmael, and Chakuchanya Harawa was the voice of Pitilizani. Special thanks to Peter Jegua and to the staff at Reprieve for their help with this episode.